I'm Nathan Sterner, in for Tom Hall, and this is the Midday News Wrap.
He's a showboat. He's a grandstander. The FBI has been in turmoil. You know that. I know that. Everybody knows that.
But does everybody know that? The president's comments come in the wake of his stunning decision to fire FBI Director James Comey earlier this week. Initially, the White House said Comey's dismissal came at the recommendation of Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein for Comey's handling of the Hillary Clinton email investigation. But in an interview with NBC's Lester Holt, the president says his decision to fire Comey came before he got that recommendation. Democrats aren't buying it. They say Comey was fired because of the FBI's investigation into Russia's interference in the 2016 election. John Fritzi of the Baltimore Sun, Julie Rovner of Kaiser Health News, and Dr. Terry Ann Scott of Hood College join me to make sense of it all, plus other news of the week. The Midday News Wrap up next, right after the headlines. I'm Nathan Sterner, in today for Tom Hall, and welcome to the Midday News Wrap.
Regardless of recommendation, I was going to fire Comey, knowing there was no good time to do it. And in fact, when I decided to just do it, I said to myself, I said, you know, this Russia thing with Trump and Russia is a made-up story. It's an excuse by the Democrats for having lost an election that they should have won.
That was a moment from President Donald Trump's interview with NBC's Lester Holt last night. This, of course, in response to questions about the president's choice to unceremoniously fire FBI Director James Comey earlier this week. The president and his administration contend that he fired Comey in part because of the way he handled the Hillary Clinton email investigation, but Democrats are crying foul. They believe Comey's dismissal has more to do with the FBI's investigation into the Trump administration's ties with Russia. And in that clip, President Trump may have given some credence to that association, as he cited the, quote, Russia thing as being on his mind when he decided to do it. The president also says Comey made it clear to him on three separate occasions that he was not under investigation. According to the New York Times, just a week ago, Comey asked the Justice Department for additional resources to accelerate the Bureau's investigation into Russia's interference in the presidential election. This is, of course, the big story of this week, and we will be talking about it a lot on today's Midday News Wrap. Joining us to make sense of it and some of the other week's top news is John Fritzi. He's the Washington correspondent for the Baltimore Sun, and he's on the phone from the Sun's newsroom. Hey, John.
Hi, Nathan.
Also with us, Julie Rovner, the chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News. She's on the line from Kaiser's offices in Washington, D.C. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And Dr. Terry Ann Scott is here with me in studio. She is an assistant professor of history at Hood College in Frederick. So good to have you here.
Pleasure to be here.
So the big news this week, President Trump's decision to fire FBI Director James Comey. The narrative from the White House about how this decision came about has changed quite a bit since the story broke Tuesday afternoon. At the start, a letter written by Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein was at the center of the rationale. Until a couple weeks ago, Rosenstein was Maryland U.S. Attorney. And John Fritzi, you've covered him in the past. Can you detail for us the letter he wrote and what the Trump administration did or says it did with it?
Sure. So, on the first day that this happened, the White House was clearly pointing to Rosenstein's memo. If you looked at the statements, the president had a very short statement that referenced, advice from the Justice Department officials, including Rosenstein. Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who has ostensibly recused himself from the Russia issue, issued a similar sort of one-paragraph short statement. And it was really Rosenstein's memo, which was a three-page document that sort of laid out the public rationale at the time for why this was happening. And, you know, the basic argument from Rosenstein was that Comey had forced a number of errors in the sort of investigation into the Clinton email issue, that he spoke when he shouldn't have, said things he shouldn't have said, and so forth. And I think, you know, politically, there's a lot of agreement on that, right? I mean, I think...
None of these things haven't been heard before. I mean, these things were all said last year when he was doing these things.
That's right. I think Comey managed to anger both Democrats and Republicans, so that's not a surprise. But you're right. The issue here is timing, and that there still isn't a good answer from the White House about the timing, about why this happened this week. And I also think that these inconsistencies are a real problem. If you're going to do something like this, generally a White House sort of gets its story straight. And part of the reason why is these inconsistencies, I think, just add oxygen to the fire you know, initially the rationale had to do with the Clinton email scandal, and increasingly it looks like it had to do with the Russia probe. And the White House hasn't done anything to sort of help its case to put the focus back on Rosenstein's original rationale.
And I want to stay with Rosenstein just a little bit longer because, well, for a good long while, he was ours. Do we know how the Rosenstein letter came about? Was he asked to deliver it? Was he told to deliver it?
Well, according to the White House, Rod Rosenstein and Jeff Sessions met with President Trump on Monday of this week. The initial explanation that came from the press deputy press secretary on, I believe it was Wednesday, was that they came to Trump with these recommendations that Trump had said to them, look, put it in writing, and that once he got the memo on Tuesday, that's when he, you know, that's when he executed the firing. You know, that story has changed a little bit, particularly after President did an interview with NBC a couple of days later in which he said, look, I was always going to fire Comey regardless of what the recommendations came back with. And intervening between those two things is this interesting little nugget, which is reports that Rosenstein was angry about how the White House had characterized things, and that he had actually threatened to resign over how the narrative was developing out of the White House. And so, you know, one plausible look at this is that the White House is reshaping its message a little bit because of Rosenstein's concern.
Now, apparently, Rosenstein said to one reporter yesterday that the talk of a resignation wasn't true, but he didn't appear to say too much. Rosenstein has long had a reputation as being apolitical. I think that's the most commonly used word to describe him. What is this situation doing to his reputation?
Well, I think it's testing it, and I think that that's absolutely right. He, you know, he won a confirmation just a few weeks ago with all but six Democratic votes. He won wide support in the Senate Judiciary Committee, and he, you know, he came out of Maryland with a lot of support from Democrats. Now, you know, a lot of what Rod Rosenstein did in Maryland was not political, right? So it's easy to be non-political when you're prosecuting gangs and prisons and so forth. Everybody supports that. He did do some political investigations, including one in Prince George's County, but he did. He's always sort of been seen as a straight shooter. You know, I think one of the things that interested me was how heavy the White House leaned on that on Tuesday. I mean, they were really leaning on, look, Rod Rosenstein is this, you know, a straight shooter. He's a non-political guy. They were really, I think, using his reputation to sort of explain why this wasn't a political move that was being done. But, you know, that's being tested. And even the next day, you had Chuck Schumer, a Senate Minority Leader, on the floor saying that, you know, that they no longer felt that that Rosenstein should be in charge of Russia, and they Schumer said that, you know, the whole episode had raised serious questions about his impartiality, and so I think you know, Rosenstein has potentially some repair to do here too if he wants to maintain that reputation. And you know, the most recent sort of development with him is that he will appear apparently before the entire Senate to sort of answer some of these questions someday next week.
Of course, Rosenstein is in charge of the investigation into Russia because Jeff Sessions, the Attorney General, has had to recuse himself.
Yeah, that's right. Jeff Sessions, who was a campaign surrogate for Trump and who, in his own confirmation hearing at one point, answered a question by saying, you know, he never had any contact with the Russians during the campaign. It later came to light that actually he had met with the Russian ambassador a number of times. That story sort of exploded. He had to amend his testimony a little bit before the committee. You know, he argued that those meetings were in his capacity as a senator and had nothing really to do with the campaign. People can, of course, draw their own conclusions, but that firestorm is what led him to recuse himself and sort of put this in Rod Rosenstein's lap even before he was confirmed, long before he was confirmed. And so, you know, he got a lot of questions about this during his confirmation process, and insofar as there was some criticism or concern about him, it was about this idea of a special counsel and whether he would appoint one. And he didn't answer that. He wouldn't answer it. You know, he said that he didn't want to make that decision until he was in the job and had all the facts.
Which is a good political thing to say in a confirmation hearing.
Well, not, I mean, I think you could make an argument that it's also probably a decent legal thing to say. I'm not sure he would... that anybody would answer that question before being confirmed I think he had a decent legal argument as well as a good political argument. Now those calls, because of this, are getting more and more intense.
What are the calls like now? I know that Maryland Attorney General Brian Frosch has signed on to a letter with a bunch of other attorneys general from around the country calling for an independent special counsel in the Russia investigation.
Right. Well, I mean, basically every Democrat, I think, would like to see that happen and are calling for that. And so now it's just sort of a piling on at this point. But yes, Democrats would very much like to see it. Republican leaders so far have resisted that a little bit. Mitch McConnell has argued that, hey, look, we've already got this investigation underway in the Senate Intelligence Committee. There's a House investigation that's still going on officially. And, his argument is that if you add another layer in, that would sort of get in the way of those investigations that are already underway. Democrats would argue that those investigations have run into a lot of problems. Even the Senate Intel investigation, which is arguably the most bipartisan at this point, has had issues with speed and staffing, and there's a lot of concerns that that group is not adequately staffed to move forward and handle this. And so I think that's sort of the Democratic argument that someone needs to come in independently and look at this. And it's interesting that, everybody had confidence in Rosenstein's ability to do that. Now, because of this memo and how it's been messaged by the White House, a lot of them, I think, no longer do.
And the decision is still up to Rosenstein about what to happen.
Yes.
Now, Rosenstein, while his letter may have been the basis for the firing, at least initially, according to the White House, President Trump walked that bat back a bit yesterday, saying that he had already decided to get rid of Comey, alleging turmoil in the FBI. He had already made that decision before he got the letter of recommendation. Of course, earlier this week, FBI Director Andrew McCabe, acting FBI director, said that Comey enjoyed broad support within the FBI and still does to this day. What do we know about the ongoing investigation into alleged Russian meddling?
In terms of what the FBI is doing, not much. What has come to light over the past couple of days is that apparently James Comey, was looking for some sort of additional resources. There's been some pushback on that from the Justice Department. They flatly denied that Comey had approached Rod Rosenstein looking for additional resources and/or access to prosecutors, but it seems to be a pretty wide consensus that Comey was talking to people on the Hill or getting ready to talk to people on the Hill. That there was a sort of a thought of somehow expanding the investigation or ramping it up to some degree. What direction that takes, I don't think anybody knows. But that we know that, and then we also know that the acting FBI director, as you noted. Andrew McCabe contradicted the White House in testimony yesterday, saying that his feeling was that this investigation was significant, and that's a little bit different than the tone we got from the White House the day before, in which they said, the FBI has a lot of things they're doing, and this is just one one small piece of it.
And I think they downplayed the size of the importance of the investigation, didn't
right,
they?
Right, right. And these these contradictions, I think, are what would keep this story is going to be alive for a while anyway. But the contradictions just add fuel to the flame in terms of the coverage, because until these questions get resolved, people are going to keep writing about it. Obviously, I think the question is what the impact for me, I think, is sort of what the impact is here. And you've got a president who has a pretty ambitious agenda, right? He wants to do a health care bill. He wants to do tax reform, infrastructure, right? These are things he talked about on the campaign. In as much as we're talking about Russia and the FBI, we're not talking about any of those things. Add to that now the Senate, which is a slow-moving body and can really only handle one big thing at a time, has to confirm a new FBI director. And if Comey's hearing was hard, and it did get a little testy, whoever his replacement is that person's going to have an even more difficult a hearing, I think, because Democrats and maybe even some centrist Republicans are going to, I think, be asking some tough questions. And so this White House has shown a propensity, I think, even back to the campaign, of kind of stepping on its own message and getting in the way of its own agenda. And I think, you know, one of the questions here is, you know, what happened this week, how does that impact his ability to move any other of his legislative ideas through the Congress?
In yesterday's interview with NBC, President Trump said that Comey had told him three times he was not being investigated in relation to Russia. Let's listen to that.
We had a very nice dinner, and at that time he told me, you are not under investigation, which I knew anyway.
That was one meeting. First of all,
when you're under investigation, you're giving all sorts of documents and everything. I knew I wasn't under. And I heard it was stated at the committee, at some committee level, that I wasn't. Number one.
So that didn't come directly
from
him.
Then during a phone call, he said it, and then during another phone call, he said it. So he said it once at dinner, and then he said it twice during phone calls.
Did you call him?
In one case, I called him. In one case, he called me.
And did you ask, am I under investigation?
I actually asked him, yes. I said, if it's possible, would you let me know, am I under investigation? He said, you are not under investigation.
Now, in testimony yesterday before the Senate, acting FBI Director Andrew McCabe wouldn't say whether Comey had answered such a question, but he did say the FBI typically does not answer that sort of question. Do we know anything more about this question and these answers?
Well, I don't think we do yet. I mean, I think it's hard to say. You've got Trump sort of saying these things, but he has said things before that turned out to be not totally right. And so, you know, I think we need to wait to hear from Comey, maybe his side of the story, which I'm sure we will at some point. You know, I think you've got this morning the president, you know, sort of tweeting out about he hopes there were no tapes that were recorded during these conversations. And so it's an awkward thing. I mean, the problem with Trump's version of the story, seems to me, is that you've got, you know, an FBI director who, according to Trump, is coming to make sure he can keep his job. And then you've got the president in the same conversation asking whether he's under investigation, right? So it sort of smacks of this idea that the White House is trying to push the investigation down. And whether that's true or not, you know, it doesn't really matter at a certain level, because the optics of it just don't look all that good. And combined with some of the tweets that we see from the president about the investigation being a waste of taxpayer money and a charade and so forth, I think it builds into this narrative that they took this action because of the Russian probe. And that's, you know, I think that's obviously a problem for the White House.
Oh, a lot to talk about in this topic, and I think that's where we stand, but so many things are happening. There may be aspects of this that I have missed. Julie Rovner, you're on the line. John and I have been pretty much monopolizing this conversation for the last 15 minutes. How is this investigation, how is the firing striking you?
Well, I can only tell you how it's striking what I do, which is cover healthcare, and it has pretty much paralyzed official Washington. I think that's fair to say. It's rare, I've been doing this 30 years, that you see a story that really sort of brings everybody to a halt, and it's basically all they're talking about. It was kind of amusing. I was up in the Senate Wednesday morning trying to figure out what was going on with the healthcare bill, and all of these senators who are, you know, busy as part of these investigations were thrilled to see health reporters because they didn't really want to talk about Comey, particularly the Republicans. Democrats did, but the Republicans, when they would see a health reporter, was like, hey, you want to talk about health care? Whereas the day before, when health care was, you know, sort of topic number one, they didn't want to talk about it at all. So it is one of these stories that just sort of keeps rolling along. And it's at some point, I think what John was saying is right. It starts to, particularly in the Senate, which is where the health bill is now, it starts to impinge on other things that the Senate is supposed to be doing and starts to kind of gum up the works.
We'll be talking about some of the other things that the Senate is supposed to be doing when we get back. Julie Rovner is the chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Dr. Terri Ann Scott is with us. She's an assistant professor of history at Hood College in Frederick. And John Fritzy, of course, the Washington correspondent for the Baltimore Sun. You are welcome to join in our conversation after the break. You can call us now to be on the line after the break. Our number is 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org. You're listening to the Midday News Wrap. Stick around. listening to the Midday News Wrap here on your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. I'm Nathan Sterner in for Tom Hall. Coming up Monday, Tom is back, and he'll be bringing you a conversation about the way we categorize and prosecute hate crimes. According to the Southern Poverty Law Center, reports of hate crimes in the U.S. are on the rise. But do the laws we have in place actually protect people from being harassed or assaulted for their race or gender or religion or sexual orientation? That is a question that we will be answering Monday on Midday. Hope you'll join us then. If you're just joining us now, it's the Midday News Wrap. I'm Nathan Sterner. Julie Rovner, the chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News, is with us. Prior to her roles at Kaiser, Julie covered health policy for NPR for 16 years. John Fritzy, also with us, Washington correspondent for the Baltimore Sun. And Dr. Terry Ann Scott is an assistant professor of history at Hood College in Frederick and is with me in studio. We've been talking about the firing of FBI Director James Comey for the beginning of this program. We will likely come back to it as the program progresses. But right now, I want to go to you, Julie, because before the firing, it looked like healthcare was going to be the big topic on the news this week. The GOP healthcare bill passed in the House 2017 to 2013 last week. It's now to the Senate, and I understand that the House bill in the Senate is essentially DOA, and Senate Republicans are working to come up with a plan of their own?
Well, that's what they're saying. And there's a 13-member working group of all white men who are working on coming up with a plan of their own. Remember, they're operating under these special budget rules that mean that they don't need the usual 60 votes. They can get away with just 50. But there's only 52 Republicans, so they can only lose two and then have Vice President Pence break the tie if they want to get this bill through. And they were literally just starting when all of the Comey news broke. They've had a couple of closed-door meetings this week. It's unclear how long this will take. There are suggestions that perhaps the Senate might try to do a very minimal bill, sort of the least they can, in order to just get to conference with the House. But finding a bill that can get 218 votes in the House and 50 votes in the Senate is not going to be easy. There's an awful lot that Republicans disagree on when it comes to health care.
The bill that came out of the House was passed before the Congressional Budget Office got a chance to score it, so we don't know exactly what it would do. Is the CBO scoring the House bill? Is that yet to come?
Yes, the CBO is scoring the House bill. They announced earlier this week that they would have their score out the week of May 22nd, so not next week, but the week after. We know pretty much what the bill would do. The only thing the CBO hasn't scored were those last controversial amendments about letting states apply for waivers of the rules protecting how much you can charge people with who might not be healthy and age rating and the essential benefits. But that's going to be difficult for the Congressional Budget Office to score. I'm sure that's what's taking so long, because they have no idea how many states might apply for these waivers or which states. So it could be a very small change to the estimate or a very large change to the estimate, particularly in how many people they think will lack insurance. Remember, the original estimate of the bill said that it would cause 24 million fewer people to have insurance after 10 years.
How would the applications for waivers work? If a state applied for a waiver, would it get them? What would a state have to do to even apply?
Well, the sort of universal understanding is that, yes, it would be pretty easy to get those waivers. What the state would have to do is demonstrate that it had some way to help people who had pre-existing conditions get coverage. They added $8 billion for high-risk pools, which is where people who have been sick have gone in the past if they couldn't get their own coverage in the individual market. Those, by and large, didn't work very well. There was a federal one during the transition to the full Affordable Care Act implementation. It ended up closing about a year early because it ran out of money. That's pretty much what happened in most of the states. Would that $8 billion be enough? It depends on how many states would ask for these waivers and which states. If it's a couple of small states, it would presumably be plenty of money. If you had one or two big states, it would clearly not be enough money. So it's all kind of vague at this point. Another question is whether that language is even allowable in the Senate. Remember, they're operating under these budget rules. Every provision of the bill has to meet the rules that it primarily be budget related. And there are a lot of people who think that this is not even almost budget related, and that if they wanted to bring it to the Senate floor under these budget rules, they probably couldn't.
Dr. Terry Ann Scott?
And also what I have found particularly disturbing about the unraveling of what's going on with healthcare this week is the changing of the narrative by many in the GOP, those who have already either voted for the bill or who plan to vote for it. And so in the face of pushback from their constituents, they have now changed the narrative and said, well, this is what we promised that we would do for you. We would repeal Obamacare. And so it places the onus on their constituents, and it allows them to kind of relieve themselves of any disdain that may be heaped upon them.
So the thing that got it through the House was the high-risk pools, replacing the requirement for essential benefits if states apply for a waiver with these high-risk pools. This is an idea that has some Maryland roots. John Fritzy, you have reported on that. Can you tell us how the high-risk pool idea played out in Maryland when it did?
Sure. I'm sure Julie is actually probably really the expert on these, but Maryland did have one, and it was one of the more successful ones in the country. We had over 20,000, I think it was about 23, 24,000 at the height enrollees in that program. And it was paid for by a surcharge on hospital bills, so everybody paid in. And actually the system made so much money that a few years in, they decided to boost enrollment by making it a little bit easier for folks to get into it, expanding the pre-existing conditions that could come in. I think they actually lowered premiums a couple of times in the pool. So it was pretty successful. But it's important to remember, like, even when we talk about Maryland's high-risk pool being successful, and I think by most accounts it was, you know, that pool had an annual cap on payouts for insurance claims. I think it was somewhere between 1 and 2 million. It also had a provision that if you had a pre-existing condition, you couldn't come into it immediately. There was like a waiting period of several months. Now, there were ways around that. You could buy that down and pay more money, but it was costly for folks involved. So it was considered the insurer of last resort, and people who were in it, I've talked to a bunch of folks who were in the program who say that, that they were grateful for it, but that what they're getting right now through the exchange in Maryland, anyway, is far better. Maryland, of course, hasn't experienced some of the same problems that other states have had with insurers pulling out, although we do have, rates are continuing to go up in the exchanges, and so that's troubling for a lot of people. But I think the most fundamental thing on these pools, as Julie pointed out, is that they could work, but every expert I've spoken to said they can work, but you have to fund them. They're expensive, because how this works, what you're doing is you're taking the most expensive people, the sickest people, you're taking them out of the exchanges and putting them into their own little insurance pool. And because they're the sickest people, they're the most expensive. And so, you know, somebody's got to pay for this, and that, I think, is the issue with these pools, is how do you pay for it.
And can I say something else about the Maryland pool in particular? I think one of the reasons that the Maryland pool worked pretty well is that Maryland had another provision that a lot of people don't know about, and I assume it's still on the books, but I took advantage of it for a while when I was self-employed, which is that you could be a small business of one and you would not get medically underwritten, which is how these people end up in the risk pool. So if you had a pre-existing condition, it didn't matter. You could be, as long as you were self-employed. So these are not for people who work at a job where they don't get insurance, but they were for freelancers and other self-employed people who perhaps didn't have any employees, and you could get insurance that way. And I actually did for several years. So even people with pre-existing conditions would then get into the small group market rather than end up in the high-risk pool.
Julie, what other things should we be looking at as the Senate debates this bill?
Well, I think one of the big issues is going to be Medicaid, the Medicaid program for people with low incomes. And, you know, most people sort of look at this bill and, you know, you've seen the headlines, and yes, it would phase out the expansion of Medicaid that was in the Affordable Care Act. But what a lot of people miss is that it would also put a cap on Medicaid spending in general. So that would affect everybody on Medicaid. The Congressional Budget Office, and this is a part that didn't really change very much, estimated that it would basically, you know, cut Medicaid spending by 25%. Over the next decade. That's a big, big cut that states would have to find some way to make up.
Funding for Planned Parenthood has also been up for debate involving the healthcare legislation. What's the Senate potentially going to do there?
Well, one of the interesting things about the Planned Parenthood ban, and it's only a one-year ban, it turns out if you do it for more than a year, it ends up costing money because women who don't get birth control get pregnant, have babies, and qualify for Medicaid. There might not be even 50 votes for that in the Senate. There are at least two senators, Susan Collins of Maine, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, who've pretty much said they won't vote for a bill that would defund Planned Parenthood. And now Dean Heller in Nevada, who's up for re-election next year, has sort of implied that himself. It's not entirely clear, but, you know, it would be this is something that must be in the bill to get through the House, and it might not be able to be in the bill to get through the Senate. So that's going to be something to watch also.
You mentioned the special budget rules in place so that the Senate can pass it with just 51 votes. Explain how those work again.
Well, this is called budget reconciliation, and it's something that the Congress does pretty often. They do a budget, and they tell the spending, you know, the appropriations committees how much they have to spend. And then if they want to change things that don't come under the authority of the appropriations bill, sort of permanent law, taxes, Medicare, Medicaid, those types of things, then they order the committees that oversee those to do a budget reconciliation bill. But in order to get that through in the Senate, there are special rules that limit debate. You can't filibuster it, and you need only a simple majority to get it through. So if you're going to do something that's complicated or controversial, or you really need to get it done soon, you do it under this process. And that's exactly what the Republicans are doing. Sort of luckily for them, they neglected to do a budget last year for the current fiscal year. And so they actually did it in January, which was 7-8 months after it was supposed to be done. And they did it with the explicit reason of getting through this health changes bill. The problem is, until they finish this, they can't do the budget resolution they're supposed to do now, and that's the one that will allow them to do tax reform. So tax reform is going to have to wait until they finish health care, or they're going to have to bail on health care if they want to do tax reform. They can't do them at the same time.
You said there's some question whether some of these provisions in the health care could be considered acceptable under these budget rules. Is there a process for challenging that? How would that happen?
There is indeed a process for challenging that. It's all up to the Senate parliamentarian, who's, you know, an appointed official. So she's been appointed by the Republicans. A majority gets to appoint the parliamentarian. And she will decide. And there's actually, you know, it's almost a legal process of sorts where, you know, those go on both sides go and argue before her that this should be allowed in and this shouldn't. And basically, it's up to her. Now, there are discussions about overruling the parliamentarian that I've heard on and off for a while. I don't believe that's ever happened. That would be kind of a change in Senate procedure that's the equivalent to getting rid of the filibuster. That would be a very big deal if that were to happen.
We're coming up on the break, but I want to go to the phones first quick. David in Towson, welcome to Middays News Wrap.
Hey, I just want to add to the conversation that being a resident of Maryland, a lot of people don't understand when we have this national conversation that I am actually, we mentioned before, I am a small business owner. I'm a business of one. And my wife actually has asthma, which is a pre-existing condition. And because of that, because we are in a little bit of a progressive state, we are protected by kind of the things the Affordable Care Act has done for other Americans in other states. So I think it's important in the discussion, talking about Maryland in particular, to say we kind of already have it. So a lot of people don't necessarily understand who are more local what they could possibly be losing because it's something that we're just used to. So I think it's kind of relevant to this discussion how Maryland is unique and we should kind of offer what works for us to other people in our country.
Julie?
I don't know how many other states have it. As I say, I knew that Maryland has it because I used it. And when I lived in the District of Columbia, they did not have it. So it was nice to move to Maryland and basically be able to buy my own health insurance. When I first did, my rates went down by about half. I know that, you know, the individual market is a difficult place to be. Again, most people have insurance through their job or through Medicare or Medicaid, some government program. But there are about 18 to 20 million Americans who buy their own insurance. And that's mostly who we're talking about. It was mostly who we were talking about with the Affordable Care Act. It's mostly who we're talking about with the Republican replacement for it. And, you know, and as the caller mentioned, in Maryland, we've sort of enjoyed this for some long time. In a lot of other states, people with pre-existing conditions couldn't get insurance until the Affordable Care Act came in. And I think that's why there's a lot of concern about it. There's a poll from Quinnipiac University that just came out that found that 75% of the people polled think that it's not a good idea to go back on those protections for pre-existing conditions, including 59% of Republicans.
Meanwhile, the cost of insurance in the individual market are going up. We heard from Maryland insurers earlier this month, maybe it was even this week, so many things are happening, asking to increase their insurance rates on the individual market. I believe, I don't have the number in front of me, but I believe that CareFirst Blue Cross Blue Shield suggested an increase of something like 50%. This goes before the Maryland Health Insurance Commission, John Fritzy, is that right? Do you have that?
Yeah, this is a little outside of my my expertise. Our healthcare reporters in Baltimore covered this. But yeah, that's my understanding, that it was, I think it was, Blue Cross Blue Shield, I think, was looking for a 50% increase in Maryland. And, you know, I just don't have a lot of insight into how, you know, what the prospects of that are. I will say, to the caller's point, I mean, it is true that Maryland, insofar as there are options to waive in or waive out of these various protections, it's unlikely that the politics in Maryland will allow that to happen, at least in the short term. You know, and there are these protections on the book, some of them pre-Obamacare, but, you know, Obamacare did have a big impact in the state. I think we've got something like almost 200,000 people in private coverage, you know, in other words, buying, you know, buying on the exchanges, and then something, several hundred thousand more, I think it's maybe 300,000 or so more that were signed up through for Medicaid, through the expanded Medicaid program. So, you know, cuts to that program or changes in how the exchanges operate, you know, will affect Marylanders, even though I think the caller is right. The politics and the stuff that's already on the books before ACA will provide Maryland probably with more protections than you'll see in other states.
That's John Fritzy, Washington correspondent for the Baltimore Sun. Julie Rovner with us, the chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News, also joined this afternoon by Dr. Terry Ann Scott, assistant professor of history at Hood College in Frederick. And we've got to go to break more when we return, plus your calls and emails, 410-662-8780 or midday at WIPR.org. You're listening to the Midday News Wrap. I'm Nathan Sterner in today for Tom Hall, joined today by John Fritzy of the Baltimore Sun, Julie Rovner of Kaiser Health News, and Dr. Terry Ann Scott, assistant professor of history at Hood College in Frederick. A very, very busy news week. One of the things that happened is a commission that was launched by President Trump to study voter fraud and suspicion. Earlier this year, the president claimed that between 3 million and 5 million people who were not in the country legally voted in November's election. No evidence has been given for that, but this commission is designed to study it. Terry Ann, what do we know? Where is this going to go?
Well, you know, to begin with, I don't know if the correct adjective would be ironic or laughable, because as you mentioned, so here we have this claim that is unsubstantiated, that 3 to 5 million illegal immigrants voted for Hillary Clinton. And so Trump has created this commission to investigate those claims, when in actuality, what he should be investigating are actual substantiated claims of voter suppression, such as the voter ID laws that we have in place, the redistricting, the cutting of early voting, all of these things that have been implemented since the election of Barack Obama and that have kind of had an uptick since the Shelby case before the Supreme Court. And so, for instance, we know for a fact that those have caused suppression. A recent study came out of Wisconsin, for instance, that said at least 200,000 individuals were unable to vote in the last election because of voter ID laws. Now, how many votes did he win by? Just over 22,000. And so the investigation for voter suppression is going clearly in the wrong direction.
What direction should it? What direction is it going in, and what direction should it go in? Your
so it
opinion?
Seems to be going in the direction to substantiate Trump's claims that these individuals have voted illegally. In fact, one of the people that he put on the commission is somebody who very much so stands for voter ID laws. What we have found is that these voter ID laws specifically target minorities and Democratic leaning individuals, and those are the individuals whom they largely disenfranchise. And so, under the last administration, the Department of Justice had worked very closely with other organizations, including the Legal Defense Fund, to litigate some of those laws and have very much successfully done so on particular levels. And I believe one of the cases is set to go before the Supreme Court. And so here we have then cases where both minorities and Democratic-leaning individuals have been clearly disenfranchised. But obviously, this is not part of his agenda to attempt to dismantle such actions.
That study you cited, what, 200,000?
Approximately 200,000 voters in the state of Wisconsin.
Were suppressed because of voter ID laws.
Correct.
Of course, the rationale for voter ID laws is to try to prevent fraudulent voting, double votes, or something like that. And that's not something that we see that much of.
Not at all.
At least
the numbers
that
are
we have evidence
correct.
Of.
Correct. The numbers are extremely minimal. And the way that it is cast is something that is essentially an epidemic, which in fact it is not. And the voter ID laws are not the only things that are then used. We have the redistricting. We have the closing of DMVs, and particularly largely minority and Democratic-leaning areas. And
DMVs, of course, if you need a voter ID, you need to have an ID from that DMV.
That is correct. And the discontinuing of early voting. And what we have found in particular areas is that disproportionately, the people who engage in early voting are, in fact, minorities who tend to vote Democratic.
There's a... Excuse me. Another story out this week that the head of the U.S. Census Bureau is resigning, and the census, the 2010 census, is fast approaching. Plans have to be together for that soon. How does that factor in?
Right. So the true implications of an underfunded census are yet to kind of have been shown to us. What we do know is that the census is used to truly gauge the welfare of America and society, particularly those in underserved communities. And so without an accurate counting of the needs and the interests and the numbers of people in those underserved communities, then how are we to know what to fix, essentially?
And it is the people in underserved communities that are usually the most difficult to count?
Quite often, yes. Those are the ones that are harder to reach, that people have to kind of go out and seek and get that information from. And of course, that requires funding.
And that affects districting, that affects congressional apportionment, and of course, that affects the whole slew of other things that census data is used for.
Absolutely. And so the resignation of the head of the Census Bureau hints toward a concern over that kind of limited analysis.
I also want to talk about our Education Secretary Betsy DeVos's appearance at a college commencement recently.
Right. And so we know that she was there to give the commencement speech. And just at the beginning of her speech, then a number of the students both started to kind of shout out their discontent over her presence, as well as stand.
This is at Bethune-Cookman.
That is Bethune-Cookman College. That's correct. And stand and turn their back to her. Now, this was not some singular incident. Previous to her speaking, they had submitted as many as 50,000 signatures on a petition that asked for them to not have her speak. They had also had a numerous protests. What I find very interesting, and they had done this for several reasons, both first because they were protesting her rollback of the Obama era restrictions on student loan fees, as well as her casting HBCUs as pioneers of school choice.
And Bethune-Cookman is a historically black university.
It is a historically black college and university. And so when she cast HBCUs as pioneers of school choice, what she demonstrated was a clear disregard for the idea and for the reality that HBCUs in a post-emancipation era were the only choice because of segregation. And so the students engaged in this protest. What was particularly, I find, disturbing about that was that the president then, about a minute into her speech, stopped her and told the students that if you continue this, we will mail you your degrees. And so he admonished them publicly, which really kind of flies in the face of treating institutions as these spaces of free thinking.
I assume that the president of Bethune-Cookman was aware there would be some protests when
protests had already started before she spoke, within the days leading up to her speaking, as well as the submission of the petitions with signatures that opposed her speaking. So, yes, he was fully aware of it.
Do you know why she was chosen to be the commencement speaker in the first place?
One of the things that he suggested, and that I believe the head of the Negro, United Negro College Fund suggested, was that this was an attempt to, so to speak, reach across the aisle, to kind of make amends with others who do not necessarily think in the way that some people do.
Okay, let's go to the phones now. Noah in Baltimore, welcome to the Midday News Wrap.
Hey, thanks for having me. I feel like what I originally called about was sort of was about this FBI thing, and then there's just like clearly so much to talk about. It's like hard to
the news cycle is spinning so fast these days.
It's in part it's hard to believe. It really is. But my My sort of original question was, like, in terms of the optics of the FBI thing, where you have a president who fires the FBI director and then the next day meets with the Russian foreign minister behind closed doors without the U.S. press present, and then goes and, like, tells a sort of, like, shifting story about it. Like, I'm just, maybe I'm too hopeful here, but is this, like, something that is going to end in his impeachment? Is this end to this nightmare in sight? Where are we? What's happening?
John Fritzy?
Well, look, I don't think Trump cares about the optics. I think that's pretty clear. I think we saw it throughout the campaign. And, look, it's important to remember one point, which is that Quinnipiac poll that Julie pointed to, while Trump's approval rating is at historic lows overall, I think he was down below 40, maybe around 35-36%, among Republicans, he's still doing quite well. In fact, I think 82% of Republicans in that poll still had a favorable approval of the president. And so I think that, you know, insofar as what he says and does affects his legislative agenda, I think that number among Republicans will have to come down significantly before it really does. So another point on that, I think Trump doesn't care about the optics, but he's clearly getting caught by it. And if you look at the two lawsuits on, I would argue, maybe the two most significant executive orders that went beyond just studying things, at least the travel ban as one and sanctuary cities as the other, both of those executive orders are being held up in court. And the opinions in those cases relied heavily on statements that the president made or that Press Secretary Sean Spicer made. And so, you know, Trump may not care about the optics. And I think I kind of get the sense he enjoys, you know, stirring the pot and so forth. I do think that it has the potential to have ramifications, both for his agenda if his poll numbers continue to slide, and in the courts if judges are going to be relying on these statements and comments. You know, words matter, and so I think it does matter. In terms of the meeting, I mean, it was a totally unusual situation to see both the Russian foreign minister, but then also Henry Kissinger. With the White House pool was sort of stationed outside waiting to see Trump with the foreign minister. When they walked in, Lavrov was gone, but Henry Kissinger was there. Of course, high official in the Nixon administration at a time when Democrats were making claims of Nixonian tactics. And so I do think it's interesting. You know, the White House has explained that by saying, look, these meetings were scheduled a long time ago, and you know, Trump's argument, in a way, interesting, sort of similar to the argument Obama made during the 2008 Democratic primary, was that, hey, you know, I'm going to talk with these people, I'm going to meet with them, and I'm not going to not meet with them just because we have problems with the country.
And our caller Noah mentioned that in that meeting with Russia's foreign minister, the U.S. press wasn't there, but the Russian press was.
Yeah, this is a really interesting situation. So initially, the argument was that that the White House had allowed in the Russian's official photographer. So, you know, leaders have official photographers. The president has one. President Obama had one. I don't know if Trump's appointed one yet or not, but Obama certainly had one. And so the argument went that, well, you know, the official photographers were there. I guess Trump did have one there because they later released official pictures on social media that were U.S.-based. But the problem with this photographer is that he also worked for the Russian news agency, and those pictures went out on the website shortly after the meeting. Look, you know, press, I don't cover the White House full-time. I'm over there a fair amount. You know, access in some ways is still a problem. In other ways, it's not so bad. And so it's definitely different than the previous administration. All administrations handle this stuff differently. Trump has a complicated relationship, certainly, with the press.
I think a complicated relationship with the press is an understatement.
Well, and it is, because on the one hand, you know, he's obviously has the rhetoric. On the other hand, you know, he'll complain about the New York Times and then bring them in for an interview, and everybody else. So that's not the way necessarily it always worked under Obama. And so I do think, you know, that was an extreme instance that sort of underscores that I sort of think, in a way, they're still kind of getting their feet on the ground a little bit with how they're
And President Trump even tweeted this morning that maybe we shouldn't have briefings, maybe that the press should have to submit questions and they would answer them by writing. Anyway, lots of stuff to talk about this week. Maybe next week will be a little bit calmer. We've got to wrap up our midday news wrap right now. We've been joined by Dr. Terry Ann Scott, Assistant Professor of History at Hood College in Frederick, Julie Rovner, Chief Washington Correspondent for Kaiser Health News, and John Fritzy, Washington Correspondent for the Baltimore Sun. Information and links to their reporting online at WIPR.org/midday. Thanks, all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And everybody, stay tuned to your public radio. It's been the Midday News Wrap.